Welcome, everyone, to the December Roundtable. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and I'm honored to be joined today by Kim Marshall. Kim is the author of The Marshall Memo and the new book, Volume 1 of the Best of The Marshall Memo. We'll have a podcast out about that soon that we recorded recently. And of course, Kim is the author of, this is the old version, but several editions of Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation. And Kim, I don't think I'll ever get rid of this version because this was the one I read as a new principal. And I have to say, it was far and away the single most impactful book that I ever read as a principal. The one that really helped me understand the importance of getting into classrooms as a principal, of being in classrooms, not just when I was required to, but being in there frequently and having a relationship with teachers and a way of working with teachers that went beyond the formal observation requirements. So, Kim, welcome to the roundtable.
Thank you.
I wonder if we could just do a kind of a brief bio. Tell us about your professional background and what you've been up to for the last 17 years or so.
The last 16 years, I've been, that's my post-principal life. So I was in the Boston Public Schools for 32 years as a sixth grade teacher, then as a central office curriculum director, and then as a principal for 15 years of a large elementary school in Boston, the center of Boston. Then I got exhausted, and part of my message to people is don't burn yourself out, pace yourself, have a life, and so forth. But in the last 16 years, I've had a less intense life, but still pretty intense. The three halves of my life right now are the Marshall Memo, which is Sunday and Monday. I just finished this week's issue late last night. It's sending out right now around the world. The second half of my life is coaching principals, and I'm on my way down to New Jersey in the middle of today to work with three different districts in the middle of New Jersey. And then the third half of my life, if you can do the math, is a lot of presenting and talking and consulting on the issue of teacher supervision, differentiation, understanding by design, backwards unit design, and several other topics.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Thank you. Yeah, so I think it's helpful to go into kind of the origin story of the work that that you did in this book, Rethinking Teacher Supervision and Evaluation, which was part of the origin story of my work. And again, I owe you a huge debt of gratitude intellectually and as a thinking partner before you knew you were my thinking partner. And it's been just a real privilege to correspond with you over the years as I was writing my book and to get your feedback and your pushback in some cases that was really helpful in that. But you had some realizations as a principal around the typical state of teacher evaluation. And I think you have, some very strong grounding, and certainly we have some colleagues who did some pioneering work in teacher evaluation, like John Safier. What did you start to realize required a different approach or a different perspective as you did teacher evaluation the best way it can be done, and then kind of pushed up against the boundaries of that?
So I stormed into the principalship of a large elementary school, sort of 600 students, 42 teachers and other staff in 1987 with a lot of energy about this very issue because I had been trained by John Safier. He was a close friend of mine. We worked together on the early editions of his book, The Skillful Teacher. And I really believed in the traditional model of in-depth classroom visit staying for the whole period, writing up in depth, every detail as thoroughly as possible, and then writing that up, two or three pages of detailed write-up, and then sitting with the teacher and going over it. So I really was wedded to that, and I was very good at it. In fact, teachers actually speculated that I was wearing a hidden microphone because I got so much down on what was happening in their classrooms. But at some point, after about 5 years of doing this and kind of exhausting myself trying to do as many of these as possible, I realized, because I was told by teachers, that they really weren't reading these very carefully, that they knew what was going on because they were there. There wasn't any big revelation in my detailed write-up, what they cared about was the rating they got at the end. And so they skipped to the end. And so really, I began to realize, and I was a slow learner, it took me a while, that this process really wasn't helping to move instruction. It was merely documenting what was already happening. And occasionally I gave suggestions. There were occasionally tearful conversations about criticisms I made, but it really wasn't moving the ball. In fact, in my retirement dinner when I left in 2002, one woman who had come to tears in one of my critiques, I asked her if she remembered that moment. And she, at the retirement party, and this is what we're talking like 14 years later, and she said, "Oh yes, I remember that." And I said, "Well, what was your big takeaway from that?" And she said, "Never to take a risk." So that was kind of not really what I wanted to hear, and I kind of began to suspect that. So anyway, about 6 years in, I got a suggestion from our phys ed teacher, a guy named Julio Avila. "Now, why don't you lighten up a little bit, Kim? You know, you're kind of burning yourself out here." I mean, he was very perspicacious. "And, you know, why don't you come on our classrooms more informally, and why don't you talk to us about what you see instead of, you know, staying up all night writing these long things?" And that's what I did. And right away, it was embraced by our union folks, who were very skeptical, but very quickly in the first couple of cycles. And people began to enjoy these conversations. And I got better at seeing what was important in short visits in classrooms, and got my frequency up. And I was seeing people 10 or 11 times each year, and kept that up for 9 years. And then began to write about it, present about it, and the rest is history. I should quickly add that I'm not the only person who thought of this idea. I mean, Carolyn Downey had written a book called The 3-Minute Walkthrough a few years earlier, which I had not seen. And I think a lot of principals sort of stumbled upon this approach. However, as you sort of alluded to a minute ago, they continued to be required to do the traditional system. And what I was able to do, and I think I'm fairly rare in this, is I was able to actually toss the old system completely overboard. We got a waiver. There was a provision in the Boston contract at that point that with a faculty vote, you could get a waiver. So we simply stopped doing traditional evaluations, and it became entirely short, frequent, unannounced visits, face-to-face feedback, and then sort of a kind of a write-up at the end of the year.
Yeah, so you realized that when teachers would get the big long write-up that you put hours and hours and hours into, they'd pull it out of their mailbox, and then they'd do this. They'd flip to the last page, and they'd look at what you what you marked. They'd make sure that they were satisfactory, and that was kind of it. Like the you were seeing that the growth was not there, the reflection was not there, and you used the phrase in the book, kind of a dog and pony show, that the process had become just a formality, a game of going through the motions. How did that change when you adopted this much more frequent practice of unannounced visits?
Well, the first thing was I began to see what was not the dog and pony show. I began to see everyday practice. And that, of course, is what really matters in terms of student learning, is what teachers consistently do on a day-by-day basis. And I saw some wonderful stuff and really hugged people about that. But I also saw mediocre practices. For example, a teacher only calling on the kids to raise their hands, or a teacher using sort of crappy worksheets, or a teacher slow getting off the mark in the morning, you know, half hour into the day and things really haven't gotten going yet. Those sort of mediocre practices that are not scandalous and certainly not fireable, but which people need to work on. And I began to get people feedback on these. And I think it really sort of moved the ball. Our school did much better. It also really contributed, I think, to a good professional climate of trust. And, you know, the research out of Chicago and elsewhere is the trust is one of the most important things. So I think building trust was a really, really important part of this.
Yeah, well, let's talk about trust for a minute, because I think there's a sense of safety that teachers get from the fact that formal observations are pre-announced and scheduled, and they know when you're coming. They can prepare extra the night before. They can prepare the kids the day before, and, you know, kind of create the optimal conditions for you to see them at their best. And that sense of safety can contribute to that sense of trust. But what did you see as some of the differences trust-wise with your approach when you started coming more often and unannounced?
Well, for one thing, it may seem safe if things go well, but what if things don't go well? Or what if the principal doesn't like the special lesson? Or what if the technology fails? Or what if you get tongue-tied out of nervousness and so forth? So really, it may seem safe in one sense, but it's very dangerous and kind of scary in another sense. So when I shifted to this, to the mini-observation approach, as I call it, I think people were nervous at first, and if we had a blood pressure cuff on people when I walk in. And probably the blood pressure went up a little bit. But people got used to it. And then the trust was really built by the fact that there was this face-to-face conversation afterward. I see variations on this in my travels. For example, people who send an email before they leave the classroom. They bring their laptop in and they sort of write some notes and they send an email, or they leave a note on the teacher's desk. I'm a big proponent of the face-to-face conversation. I believe you agree with this as well. That really builds the trust, because then, you know, whatever notes you were jotting down, the teacher can see that you're referring to those, and they kind of realize there isn't any magic box that things are going into. And the biggest insight, and I really got this language from Paul Bamrick Santoyo, who's another writer and practitioner who was in this camp, is the idea of focusing on one leverage point, not trying to give this teacher a detailed sort of synopsis of what happened, but focusing in with curiosity on, you know, wondering why you did this, or this seemed to be working, you know, tell me more about that, or tell me what happened after I left, or let's look at those writing things that the kids were working on. Just a really a curious, sort of low-key, non-judgmental approach. Now, of course, there are times when when you do say, you know, that needs to stop, you know, that sarcastic tone or something, where you really can have a, you know, a sharper conversation and a directive conversation with the teacher. But that happened very rarely. I mean, mostly I saw good stuff, great stuff, things I was curious about, things that weren't working particularly well, and teachers were mostly open to my suggestions, although I tried as much as possible to have the solution come from them, not to paternalistically tell them what they should be doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the, that sense of, to go back a minute or two, that sense of trust related to the stakes, I think is a big part of of what we're talking about here, that when something is the only opportunity that teachers have all year, you know, they're very nervous. As you said, people, you know, some people get tongue tied. They're fine in front of kids, but you know, when they know they're being watched by another adult, they get very nervous. And if that's it for the year, if that's their only opportunity to demonstrate that they're even competent, it becomes this very high pressure, very high stakes thing. So in your approach, you're giving people, you know, a minimum of, you know, like 9 or 10 opportunities to, you know, to demonstrate that proficiency and that competence. And then the nervousness just kind of starts, you know, maybe not the first time, but over time, the nervousness starts to go down, and you start to see people, you know, at, you know, maybe not their absolute best, but they're at their more authentic and more kind of typical, typical sense of practice. Eileen, do you want to jump in here and ask your question about how teachers responded to some of those changes? Do you want to give me a thumbs up if you want to do that? And I can unmute you here. Okay. There we go.
Hey, Kim. Hi, Justin.
Hello.
I'm curious, in the transition, how did the teachers respond, and how did you talk to them and communicate that there was going to be this change and sell it to them so that they were on board with that change? And how did you see them responding to the frequent observations, at least initially?
So I told people what I was going to do. I think they were skeptical that I would do it. You know, they could see how busy I was. You know, it's a very busy school. And I think they were nervous about my coming in. And some of them were still in this habit of having all the kids stand up and chorus, "Good morning, Mr. Marshall," which I used to get a big kick out of. But then I realized how disruptive that was. So, by the way, speaking of that, let me just do a quick sidebar here. I was in a Jewish day school in New York City a couple of weeks ago. And they said that in their schools, it's really an issue of respect that the children will stand up when an administrator comes in, and that it would be disrespectful to consider. And this teacher actually, this principal, excuse me, developed a signal. The signal was this: if she did this when she walked in, it meant respect me with your eyes, okay, but not by standing up and disrupting the class. And so that became the procedure in that school. And she walked in and did this. Now, if she did this, it meant, okay, go ahead and stand up. So in any case, I mean, the goal is to be minimally disruptive, to have instruction continue as is. And I think it only took a couple of cycles, you know, going through the 42 teachers once, with these short visits, a couple of times, and of course I was positive to start with, that was another key thing, for people to realize, okay, so this is probably better. So let's see how he does. let's see how these conversations go. And they were mostly pretty brief, mostly stand up, not in my office, you know, in the classroom or in the corridor or in the stairway or in the playground or after school. And I think the conversation is really the key part, though. That's when we really got into appreciating what was working well, appreciating funny things the kids said, moments of insight, but also getting into some of these difficult issues. Like, is that worksheet really, you know, the best way to teach this concept? Well, I've been doing this way for a while. Okay, so what about this? Have you thought of this? Or I tried this once, it didn't work, but then I tried this. That kind of conversation. So that's really what made it, I think, what built the trust and what got people. And then they saw that I actually kept it up. Now, this is partly because I have an assistant principal who is very good at a lot of the other stuff. We always split the three lunches. You know, I did 1.5, she did 1.5. And so she took care of a lot of other things that made it possible for me to do, on average, 3 of these visits a day.
Wow, that's great. Thank you.
Good deal. Yeah, Kim, I think the a big part of the trust there, thinking about some of the research on the elements of trust, is that follow through on your part. That, you know, anybody can announce at the beginning of the year, oh, I'm going to be in classrooms a lot more, and let me know anytime you want me to come by. And that, you know, we've probably all experienced that as teachers, or seen that among our colleagues, where there's this grand announcement, and then it we're pretty much back to normal, and it's January before anybody sees the principal in their classroom. So that follow through really, I think, is key there. Heather, why don't you pop in here and ask your question? Heather Bell Williams is one of our superstar members from New Brunswick in Canada.
Right.
Hey, Heather.
Hey, good morning. Kim, I think you answered most of this in the previous question, but the question I had was around some of those moments. I have one teacher, been doing walkthroughs pretty consistently, 3 a day for about 3 years now, 3 school years. One teacher's still super nervous, right? We've talked it through. She's still just, I can see it when I walk in the room. She knows exactly how many times in a school year I've been there so far. And so I'm wondering if there's specific words that you use when you might see some of that mediocre, and there's a mediocre moment, I'll call it, and you need to have that conversation. I've stopped giving her written feedback in the form of emails or notes simply because I know her nervousness is taking over. Want to build some more trust. What kinds of words do you use specifically when it's a mediocre moment, not something that's horrible that has to stop immediately?
Well, it sounds like there are two things going on here. First of all, she's nervous. Secondly, she's using mediocre practices. Is that correct?
Yes.
Aha. Okay. No wonder she's nervous.
Absolutely.
Because she knows you're critical of her. And so when you come in, there's two reasons. You're the boss, and she knows that you're looking with a critical eye at certain things that she's doing. So I think one step you've taken, it sounds like, is you've moved away from giving written feedback right away to having a conversation. Is that correct?
Yes.
So here's a question: where are the conversations taking place? Because if they're in your office, then that would add to the nervousness, right?
Right.
So maybe if you can have the conversation in the classroom when the kids aren't there, is that possible?
Absolutely. I was reading, and I don't know if it was what I read last night in your book or another journal article, but that notion of trying to be really strategic about timing those conversations. I get lost in the chaos of all that's going on during the school day, and then I end up at the end of the day, and I need to make sure that I'm maybe following through more on prep times and things like that, so that I can be strategic about the when of the conversation and not just always at the end of the day, which could tend to be in the office area.
Yeah. So I used to carry around in my pocket a shrunk down version of the schedule. So I knew when teachers' planning periods were, and I was strategic about wandering up there and catching them sometimes at the Xerox machine or, you know, some other place, some neutral place. I think definitely the principal's office is definitely a scary place. I mean, I think a lot of us still have associations from when we were students, and even teachers will say, oh, I saw you in the office, you know, is everything okay? That kind of thing.
Right.
So I think that those things, and then in the actual conversation, lots of people have different styles of starting the conversation with the teacher after a mini observation. But one might be, you know, how are things going? Or how did you feel the lesson went? I think those are a little too open-ended. I think the other approach would be, that was terrible, you need to stop doing that. Now, that would be a little harsh. So I think I've developed a set of sort of opening lines. I mean, just some minimal chit chat. Great to see you again. And then here's what struck me, or tell me a little bit about what was happening before I came in, or tell me how that worked out. Did you achieve your learning target? That sort of thing. And I think, one of the best ways to lower the stakes is to get away from judgmental language and criticism and talk about results, talk about actual mm-hmm. student learning. So if you're in there and you're actually looking over students' shoulders at the work, chatting with a couple of kids, then you can actually say, well, I talked to Melissa, and she seemed so interested in this topic, or I talked to, George and he really wasn't clear about what was going on. And that, I think, it makes teachers nervous when they see you walking around talking to kids. But at the same time, that's great sort of data, to use a horrible word, for the conversation. But I think, to me, the most important thing is get the frequency up, make it at least once a month, have the conversation as soon afterward as possible. Have the conversation before anything is written up, and focus on only one thing at a time. I mean, this teacher is probably nervous. I'd be actually curious about what the mediocre practices are, but maybe you don't want to go into that. You want to talk about that at all?
Sure. Things that you mentioned, a lot of worksheet kinds of things, follow-up activities that are very structured. She does struggle historically with classroom management, so her solution to that has been to do very structured follow-up activities where everyone is sitting quietly, allegedly sitting quietly, doing the follow-up work. She's avoiding the active learning and the manipulation of materials, say in math, in order to keep a lid on things and management-wise. Yeah.
Mm. That is so interesting. And I'm also having a little post-traumatic stress here, thinking about my own teaching, where I used worksheets very heavily to keep kids settled. And by the way, that can be a very winning strategy from a principal, is admitting, that you yourself had issues with that as a teacher. Maybe you didn't. Maybe you were a rock star from day one. But that can really set a teacher's mind at rest a little bit. But actually, speaking of worksheets, there's an interesting issue. There's also the possibility in these conversations of bringing in an outside resource. I don't know. So you get the Marshall memo through Justin, right?
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if you've ever looked in the archive, but there was a wonderful article by Jennifer Gonzalez, who I summarize frequently because she's so terrific. She's a former middle school teacher, and she just writes very, very thoughtfully and frankly. And one of her things was about worksheets. And she says there's a continuum with worksheets from what she calls busy sheets, which are just, kind of low level, like kind of low cognitive level, to what she calls power sheets. And a power sheet is a worksheet that really does get kids thinking. For example, an original source document or a real conundrum or something where it really gets them thinking. So if you can find that article, you probably know how to log into the archive and just search for Jennifer Gonzalez and look, you'll find that one right away. And maybe you suggest the teacher read that. And get into a conversation about, well, so this worksheet, was this a power sheet or was this a busy sheet or was it somewhere in between? And because I think, written work can be very powerful, but it sounds like you also want more all class discussion, more interactive stuff. Yes. And so, but that's a great conversation to have with this teacher.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I don't know if you want to model something for her. I mean, there's all kinds of ways, but what we're really talking about here is being a coach to the teacher. And I think what makes her nervous is you're coming in as the boss and the judge. If you can turn it more into, I don't know, you're probably not thinking of firing this person.
No.
She's a keeper.
Yeah.
So that they might want to hear that too. One of my favorite opening lines that I picked up from an administrator in New Jersey who remembered this when he was a teacher. The administrator said, "You're a great teacher. That lesson didn't go well. Let's talk." Mm-hmm. So notice the reassurance, the frank statement, and then the conversation, the coaching conversation around, how are we going to improve this?
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kim, I love that sense of safety to create. And I remember having very similar conversations with people saying, there is zero chance that you're going to be fired, as a result of how this is going. But at the same time, it does need to change. You know, and I think it's hard for us to say both of those things at the same time, because when we mean that something is kind of non-negotiable, that like we cannot persist in this mediocre practice forever, we do need to see a change. But we know that if people are feeling under the gun, if they feel threatened, then, you know, A, the situation is probably not dire enough that I could get rid of this person if I wanted to, and I don't want to. But B, they are going to be more successful at changing and at improving if I do create that sense of safety right off the bat. So I appreciate your frankness on that, around safety. Yeah.
Another dimension of this, and it's very helpful, especially for young administrators who are working with veteran teachers, is to simply look at the student's work. You know, if there's an exit ticket, if there's a piece of writing they did, if there's a worksheet that they did, you know, spread it out and think about, okay, so how did this go? Okay, so here's a third of the class that actually didn't get this, you know, who didn't do too well. You know, what's up with that? Are you satisfied with that, you know, teacher? They're probably going to say no. They may have excuses about that, but that's a good conversation, and it's more sort of putting it in neutral territory. Like, how did it go? You know, well, did you get your learning outcomes? Okay, so why not? And then if it becomes systematic that, you know, certain, maybe the girls are not doing so well, or the African American kids are not doing so well, then it's a conversation about instructional technique. You know, how can we up the game here so that more kids are successful, which is the goal that any teacher would embrace.
Yeah. And just the opportunity to have that as a conversation, I think, is a big shift for a lot of teachers. And I don't know what your experience was like as a teacher being evaluated, but often I feel like teachers are conditioned to just kind of sit there and accept everything, like smile and nod, agree with the weaknesses that are identified, promise to work on them. And then like soon it'll be over if you smile and nod at the right pace.
Right. And the person's not going to come back for a long time. Whereas with this method, they're coming back fairly soon. And also probably just dropping in informally a lot of the time. Like the many observations, you know, I advocate about 10 a year, which is once a month. But most of the principals I work with are around their buildings every day. And that really would be accurately labeled a walkthrough, you know, in terms of just really walking around, saying hi, but not giving feedback, but just sort of seeing what's going on, monitoring it, and maybe giving a pat on the back for things that are being picked up on that are going better. So I think that combination of being around the building a lot and then focusing on a couple a day. In most schools, it's to get to 10 per teacher per year, it means a couple a day. You know, and I think having a numerical goal is very helpful. You know, it was very helpful to me to know if I did 3 a day, you know, I could get to all these 42 people 10 times during the year. And I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a number that is shocking to a lot of people. And especially, you know, if you have some homework, if there's some writing that you have to do to document that and make that count. How did you actually make that happen in terms of the writing? Because I think, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I can probably get to the classroom, but the homework that I have as the principal, you know, like, are we back to the staying up all night to write it up? How do you get the writing down efficiently?
Well, this is where many observations have gone off the rails in a lot of districts. Working with some people in New York City in a high school in Queens, by questioning the assistant principals, I found that they were spending an hour and a half on each visit. And that just shocked me. And it's because they felt this obligation to do a detailed write-up after even a short visit. So my approach to this is to say, keep the visit to about 10 minutes. You know, most people know that 10 minutes, you know, is enough time to gather important insights and have a conversation. Have the conversation last about 10 minutes, ideally in the teacher's classroom when the kids aren't there, as soon as possible afterward. And then do a very short write-up. And the software that I love on this comes out of Tennessee. It's called T-Eval. Limits the administrator to 1,000 characters. And 1,000 characters is basically a paragraph. I can show you what it looks like, but you can picture it. It's sort of, you know, it's a paragraph like this. It takes about 10 minutes to write. So ideally, you know, one mini observation cycle is a 10-minute visit, a 10-minute conversation with the teacher, and a 10-minute write-up done perhaps in the late afternoon or maybe in the evening. So that's half an hour. And I would go out on a limb and say that any administrator who can't get into a couple of classrooms a day, have a couple of conversations, and do a couple of write-ups, something is really wrong there. you know, either they're being called out of their building a lot, or they have a lot of parents who are driving them crazy, or they have a lot of discipline issues, or they're trying to keep up with hundreds of emails during the school day. All these are reasons that would pull you away. So I just say, have a numerical goal, 2 a day, you know, get up out of your office and do those, and be systematic about spreading them around. You know, catch teachers for the conversations, because teachers are very curious. I mean, they want to know, what did you think? You know, how did it go? And then do these very brief write-ups afterward. That, to me, is the formula.
Okay, so writing less, you know, putting a character limit on it is a big part of it. The analytical aspect of the writing, I feel like often we overdo and we say, okay, in my feedback, I need to come up with some insight. Like, this needs to be, you know, like, you know, sophomore composition that you took in college. I need to write like a critical review essay of this 10 minutes of a lesson that I just saw. And I feel like often we're trying to squeeze blood from a turnip in some of that writing. Like, I know that every aspect of good instruction is here and opportunities for improvement are here. If I can just kind of squeeze the turnip a little bit harder, I will find all of these rich insights in these 10 minutes. And sometimes I would get into a classroom and I'd say, all right, here are some things to talk about, but honestly, I don't have 10,000 words for you on what I saw. Like, we can kind of talk about it in just a few minutes, and let's not try to squeeze more out of it than we need to. And I think that gets back to the formal observation once a year mindset, where that's it. Like, that is the turnip for the year, and we have to squeeze everything out of that. Or, you know, worst case scenario, we have to repeat the process, and then it's twice as much work, and you know, we're back to square one. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think the key insight is to not try to write it up before the conversation. You know, jot notes, absolutely. Get those funny quotes. Get that insight. Get that thing you noticed on the wall. Jot that down. And I advocate doing that by hand, not with a computer, not with a tablet or a laptop. Then having the conversation, and the conversation may actually change your mind. I mean, you may come in, you know, wanting to deal with one issue, and then the teacher quickly fills you in on something about that, and then you move on to another one, or the teacher brings something up. Did you notice such and such? Or that freaking, you know, smart board keeps breaking down, you know, we got to get this fixed or something. And but then, you know, ideally in the conversation, the leverage point emerges, you know, the one particular thing. I mean, for example, with the person who just came from New Brunswick, who just spoke from New Brunswick, you know, the crappy worksheets, the anxiety about classroom management, you know, tamping kids' energy down by giving them a lot of paperwork, you know, that's the issue. Talking that through with the teacher, and then the write-up is simply summarizing that. So I think it takes a lot of the stress off the write-up if you're simply, you know, it begins with, as we discussed, you know, we're going to try this approach. And I referred you to this article by Jennifer Gonzalez, and we're going to talk about that after you have a chance to read it, and, you know, that sort of thing. So the write-up is not this big sophomore essay that you referred to. And by the way, I love the metaphor of squeezing juice from a turnip. The write-up should be a simple summary rather than breaking. And you certainly wouldn't want to break new ground. You wouldn't want to say, and by the way, I also am critical of such and such. No, the conversation is where the heavy lifting is done. That makes sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what we're letting go of in that writing process, in order to let the conversation do its job, is we're letting go of the obligation to solve the problem in the written feedback. And I think that's where a lot of principals get hung up, is they see a problem, they want to fix it, so they want to document it exhaustively, they want to provide a prescription exhaustively in writing, and, you know, and take them through kind of the whole process, when that may not be realistic for the principal to do that. Like, it may be a little bit of a process for the teacher and the principal working together to figure out how to get to a better place. You know, I think especially when there are skill gaps, like, you're not going to fix a skill gap by scolding someone in writing. Like, that, mm-hmm. that takes, you know, it takes work. Mm-hmm. Let's see, Eileen, do you want to jump back on and ask your question here about voice feedback?
Sure. So, Kim, I have some colleagues in a mastermind that I'm in that have talked about getting into classrooms and effectively doing that 3 or 4 times a day. And the way that they successfully do that is they leave Voxer messages for the teachers. And I'm just curious, because I love the face-to-face when I can sit down with the teachers, and I believe it really builds trust with the faculty. I don't know how. I know they have massively large schools, so maybe they feel it's prohibitive to try and have the face-to-face. What is your perspective about a Vox message or another voice message to a teacher about their observation?
So I really have a problem with that because basically that's the principal going off half-cocked. That's, you know, because you have an impression, you may have a critique, you may have a thought and so forth, and you're going to give it, but that's, but before you've talked to the teacher, you may have gotten it wrong. You may have misunderstood a situation. You may have, you know, been overly critical. You may have missed something that was on the classroom wall. You may have, of course, you weren't there to see what happened after you left, which is, so I really think a fundamental issue of respect for teachers is the face-to-face conversation first, before anything is sort of put into any kind of electronic form. Now, the kicker here is that teachers are curious and nervous, and teachers may actually request getting something in writing or in a Vox message before the conversation. So, I mean, if you put it up to a vote with teachers, they might actually vote for that. But I'm for not being democratic here. I'm for going for best practice, which I think is having the conversation. Now, of course, another reason for avoiding the conversation might be what you mentioned, having too many teachers. But the thing is, in most schools, the ratio is about 20 to 1, 25 to 1. You know, I had 42 to 1. You know, but most schools, it's doable to do a couple a day. But there is one other issue, which is simple cowardice. You know, like simply not wanting to have a face-to-face conversation and have a difficult conversation with somebody who is, for example, using crappy worksheets or screaming at kids or, you know, only calling on the kids who raise their hands or whatever the mediocre or ineffective practice is. And this is where there are actually several good books around difficult conversations and having the courage and having the strategy of, like, how do you broach a topic that's difficult, especially if you're 28 years old and the teacher is 55 years old. And I heard a wonderful quote from one of my friends who's coaching teachers. This teacher said to her, "I've been at this for 30 years and I know what I'm doing. I don't need you." So, I mean, breaking through that takes courage, it takes strategy, it takes maybe practicing the conversation, and it may involve some tears and some difficulty. So, but that's what the job is. That's what we get paid for, is to step up to the plate and deal with those issues. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I love that both you and Justin come from the viewpoint of asking questions. You don't have to go into a conversation knowing everything about a subject matter that's outside of your content area, perhaps. But as long as you're curious and ask questions that encourage the other teacher to think and to have to answer them, and process the iceberg, the part that you don't see in that planning part, I think then you really can get to the heart of the matter. So just in case someone doesn't know what Vox is, it's like a walkie-talkie system where you can leave messages for people. So just in I know you have an understanding, but maybe someone else on the call doesn't know.
No, thanks. Well, you know, there's other clever electronic ways of giving feedback to teachers. I don't know if you've seen the bug in the ear approach, where the teacher has a Bluetooth earpiece and the principal is at the back of the room and actually talks into their ear while they're teaching. So real-time coaching, bug in the ear. So, I mean, you're laughing, you know, but there are people who swear by this. I mean, Teach for America, the program, uses this. And there's some teachers who, because they have a trusting relationship with the principal and because, you know, they're eager to learn, maybe these are brand new teachers, they appreciate hearing in their ear, you're only calling on the boys, or you haven't narrated the positive, or some tip like that. Now, that would drive me crazy. You know, I would not tolerate that. There's also the practice of actually intervening during the class. You know, my philosophy is the administrator should be like a fly on the wall. You know, should be as unobtrusive as possible. But some people cannot resist the temptation to jump in and correct a mistake, or ask a question, or contribute an insight to a discussion. You know, my feeling is, you know, like, shut up, you know, unless it's an emergency. And then you can do the bug in the ear remotely. Like, professors at ed schools will do this, you know, with a camera at the back of the room. And then, of course, there's electronic feedback, you know, sending a message, doing a Vox thing. So I'm for low tech, you know, I'm for human low tech, which takes courage and skill. I mean, there's definitely, you know, kind of an art form to doing this. There are lots of questions. I mean, you said questions are good, but there are questions that don't work so well. For example, how did you feel the lesson went? oh, it went great. It was terrific. You know, we knocked it out of the park. You know, it was a great success. You know, and then you have to say, well, actually, you're wrong. You know, I have a set of, I can send these to you if you want, a set of good lead-in questions that help. One of the most clever I've seen, this is not my own invention, is after the conversation, as the conversation gets going, saying, what did you hope I would notice? Mm. Isn't that a lovely question? Mm-hmm. You know, now, this is obviously for something that's going well, and where you're really probing, what does the teacher want you to see? Because you're only in there, you know, once out of every 100 lessons. So you know, what do you want? What's there? The new bulletin board, or this girl who is very quiet is participating, or I've taken one of your suggestions and I'm doing this. You didn't even notice it. So those are the kind of things that get good conversations going and also build trust.
That's beautiful. Thank you. I've never heard of the bug in the ear. I couldn't imagine doing it.
But some people think it's good. You know, they're smart people who are doing clever things. But I'm for low tech, curious, humble, frequent, face to face. You know, that's that sort of way. And then the electronic can be the written feedback afterward. That can be done electronically. Now that's and then the teacher opening it means that they've seen it. So. You know, you don't have to sign stuff or get formal about it. You know, so that's a good use of technology.
Thank you.
It's interesting, Kim, how, and thank you, Eileen. That's a great line of questioning there. It's interesting how the technologies that are available to us can be used well if the trust is there, if the relationship is there, if the context is right. But just about any technology can be used in kind of an abusive big brother kind of way as well. Like I've heard somebody was telling me earlier this school year about, you know, the camera system that allows the principal to watch remotely and even buzz into the classroom, you know, on kind of a, a loudspeaker in the classroom. And the story I heard was the principal was not even in the school. The principal was at home taking a personal day or a sick day and would just hop on the camera and buzz in and make a comment. You know, and certainly the technologies are always going to allow us to do both wise, well-intentioned things and ill-conceived and probably harmful things. But Kim, I really appreciate your point that this doesn't need to be complicated. It should be grounded in human interaction, because that's what this is, right? That's the business that we're in.
Yeah. And people who are using mediocre practices may not be aware that they're mediocre, may not have thought them through. They were taught that way. You know, they worked for me. Kids weren't listening and that's their fault. I mean, they have all kinds of rationales, or simply be, you know, putting one foot in front of the other and living their life and not, you know, and not getting the results that they could. So I think, you know, improving, I mean, to me, the moral issue is improving mediocre practices. You know, occasionally we have to fire a teacher who's really abusive or creepy or something else or failing in health and so forth. But those are very rare. Mostly this is an issue of moving average up, you know, improving on average, improving. And it comes down, I love the book Teach Like a Champion by Doug LaMave, which talks about specific teaching techniques that are effective and just moving people to use more of those. And the kids who benefit from most from that are the kids who are needy, the kids who walk into school with any kind of disadvantage. And there are lots and lots of those kids, and they especially need effective and highly effective teaching.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think I'd love your perspective on this, because I think you know Doug LaMave and Paul Bamberg Santoyo probably better than anyone I'm connected with. But I've also seen those strategies used, just as we can use technology inappropriately and kind of break the human interactions that should be driving this. I've seen technique used in that kind of inappropriate way. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like if we have let's say I have a list of techniques that I got from a great book, they're effective techniques, but you know, like I hear from a lot of teachers who say, my principal is kind of out of control with these teach like a champion techniques. And like, I come in and they're always like, why aren't you doing this one? Why aren't you doing number 42? What about number 35? Like, leave me alone. Like, what's the way to balance that and manage that? We have lots of techniques.
Yeah. That sounds like a kind of out of control principal. So what about having a study group where they take one chapter at a time and it's discussed, And, you know, and teachers sort of, I mean, because most teachers really like that book. I mean, we're talking about Teach Like a Champion here. I mean, it's a real teacher's book. It's about teaching. And anyone who has, you know, has any kind of, you know, sort of blood pressure around the profession, around their work is going to take to that. I remember seeing a veteran teacher, union rep in Connecticut years ago, who was kind of like someone, you know, in the middle late section of her career. You would think that she would bridle at this book that's largely for charter schools or comes out of charter schools and many sort of inner city schools. That's where a lot of Lamov's videos come from. And she loved the book. She said it was a fantastic book. It just sort of made her appreciate some things she was doing that she didn't even know she was doing and made her rethink some things. So I think it's how it's handled. I would suggest, you know, a study group, take one chapter at a time, discuss it, talk it through, push back. And there's some gaps in Lamov's work. I mean, his work is more sort of focused on classroom management than on sort of deep parts of curriculum. It's not a critique, I mean, because that was his interest. So what's missing here? What book could we use that would be more thoughtful on a particular issue? You know, there are lots of other books about teaching, you know, wonderful books about teaching. And so I think it's all about the craft of teaching. But I think back to your, you know, description of teachers being driven crazy, that comes down to just sort of thoughtless management. I mean, that comes down to, you know, being in people's faces and using a poor strategy. And I wonder if those principals are getting into classrooms, you know, if they're actually getting in and talking one issue. I mean, Paul Bamberg-Santoyo's big thing is take one thing at a time, you know, one leverage point at a time, like a good basketball coach, you know, like let's work on the dribbling. Let me show you this. Okay, try that. Okay, so I'm going to come back and look at that, you know, rather than flooding people with a whole bunch of brilliant suggestions.
Yeah. Well, and again, to get back to the idea of curiosity that you brought up just a few minutes ago, and I saw some of our panelists here nodding because my emails the last couple of days have been about curiosity. And, you know, if you see something that you think is not okay, that really needs to change, you know, rather than just getting aggressive about that and really hitting that feedback hard, getting curious about it and saying, you know, what's behind this? What are people, not what are you thinking, but, you know, what's the thinking behind the, you know, there's a big difference between what are you thinking and what are you thinking, depending on the tone, but, you know, that human side and not the feedback that is the, as you said, kind of the lacking in courage, let me drop you a voice memo and run away, or, you know, let me throw a grenade in the door and run away, so that you can't push back. What are your thoughts on that?
Teaching is so hard. I mean, let's face it. It's a really hard, and it's even more challenging now with teachers looking over their shoulders about crazy people running into their schools with guns and opioid addiction in the families. And this week's Marshall Memo that I just finished late last night has a couple of articles about stress, racial stress, other kinds of stress that kids are under, especially adolescents, but even young kids, family issues, divorce, shouting at home, you know, all these kinds of issues are going on. And teachers are dealing with that, with the pressures of accountability, with all the correcting. Both of my children are humanities teachers. One teaches high school history and my daughter teaches seventh grade English. And the amount of correcting they have, the amount of papers, my daughter has 137 papers to correct and did so over the Thanksgiving vacation. So it's just really hard. And I think there has to be a certain humanity and tact and wisdom of somebody coming into a classroom and critiquing that. I mean, you got to, you know, the three big things in there's a book called Thanks for the Feedback that I know you've seen. The three big things are teachers want to be appreciated. and whether it's a hug or a compliment or something, but it's, you know, face-to-face individual appreciation. The second thing is coaching. And it's most teachers, I would say 95% of teachers want to get better and appreciate coaching. And then the third thing is knowing where they stand. And that's back to the thing you mentioned earlier. There's a 0% chance you're going to get fired. You know, relax. You know, what we're about here is improving practice. And, you know, those three things, you know, appreciation, coaching, and reassurance, really, you know, we got to convey those in a human way. And I think the best way to do that is short, frequent classroom visits, unannounced, face-to-face conversations as soon as possible afterward, brief write-ups, and then getting the rhythm up and keeping it up all year long and really being kind of being a mensch about this business. That's what it comes down to.
Love it. Want to pass it over to Rachel. I think we've got time for one more question. Rachel was wondering, and you can go ahead and unmute if you're able to, Rachel, about getting in the conversation. Go ahead, Rachel.
Thank you. One of my struggles that I'm facing right now is finding that time for the face-to-face conversation. Not that I don't have the time, but more so my teacher's not having the time. A lot of my teachers will go all day with maybe only a 20, 30 minute break. So having to come touch base with me real quick ends up being one more thing on their to-do list, which does take them away from planning and prep and, you know, just dealing with the day-to-day. So I have been providing feedback on a tool that we use, and it's just really scripted. I'm just documenting what I see in the class, participation, totally unbiased. It's just what I see for them to see what I saw in those 10 to 15 minutes. And then I've been putting on the form if I saw something I really like great use of whatever the strategy is that I know the team's working on, or if the teacher had told me that they were struggling with a student, I'd say, you know, you're doing everything that you can, keep it up, be consistent. Here's an article I read recently on responding to trauma, you know, students experiencing trauma. Maybe some of these strategies will help. Is that more detrimental to staff, or should I continue it? Like, I will try to talk to the teachers in the classroom, but a lot of times if they're helping students or it's a direct instruction, I can't really pull them off to the side and, you know, have that quick conversation. What are your thoughts on that? And I have about 60 teachers. I'm a coach. I don't evaluate, but I do document it. And I document it to show growth for them, especially if something were to come up. And administration that supervises them, you know, they don't want to rehire, but then I can say, look at this growth. Like, look at this track record of what, you know, all these informals have gathered. What are your thoughts?
So how long is it taking you to do these write-ups after the visits?
It does take some time. It's not too much time. I think I'm getting it down to about 20 minutes per teacher. I pair every action that I've documented to a Danielson domain, but not a level, just a domain. Like, this is an artifact for, you know, assessment, or this is an artifact for engaging students, you know, that type of connection.
Yeah, I mean, it could be, and I'm not seeing your write-ups, it could be that these are very sensitive and thoughtful and helpful to teachers. What kind of reactions are you getting from teachers?
So for veteran teachers that I have built a relationship with in the past who've come to me, I receive positive feedback, because when I brought it up to them, like, should I just walk through, you know, leave a sticky note, you know, every time I'm in there, you know, a kudos sticky note. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on these walkthrough or these informals? But then they always say that they like the feedback.
Yeah, so is it changing practice? Do you see improvements?
I don't know that I'm necessarily seeing improvements just yet, but I see them utilizing the tools. You know, like, I'm seeing them take those risks, but I don't know that I've necessarily seen, like, instructional improvement. Yeah.
So I think the picture here is seems to be of you doing a lot of work and probably very good work. There's a lot of description, and then there are some suggestions and some kudos and so forth. So you have a lot of good elements there. I definitely don't think you should be giving feedback during the class. I think your instinct on that is absolutely correct. You know, you don't interrupt instruction. You don't pull them away from the kids, because they should be working with the kids. It sounds like there may be a macro scheduling issue going on here if teachers don't have any breaks during the day.
Yes, it's a huge problem for us.
It happens that my son-in-law is a middle school teacher in Boston Public Schools, and he has a schedule like that, and it's really killing him. I mean, he just simply doesn't, he hardly has time to go to the bathroom during the day.
Yeah.
And that really is, I don't know what kind of school you have, you know, it that really is a union issue. Which, you know, this is what unions are really good for, is making sure that teachers have good working conditions, which includes, you know, out of a 7-period day, a couple of periods of non-teaching periods that are spread and no more than 3 in a row and that kind of thing. So I don't know what your situation is on that.
We are charter. We don't have a union, but they do have a break, a 40-45 minute break, except they get called to sub. There's such a sub issue. that break goes away.
Well, okay, so charter schools, some of them are wonderful, and some of the best schools I've seen are charter schools, but this is one of the downsides, is if people are being burned out, and, you know, I know charter schools that have a 50% teacher turnover rate every year, and that's not good.
I think
getting to a humane and manageable schedule is one thing. But back to the face-to-face feedback, I do think, as you gathered from the previous minutes here, is I do think the face-to-face should happen before anything is written up. And I think that has numerous advantages. Your dilemma is, can you do that? Because teachers don't have time to talk to you. I'll bet that most of your teachers are really curious to hear your feedback and to talk to you. And I'll bet that they can find the time, whether it's at lunchtime or after school or before school or even a Zoom conversation late in the afternoon. I mean, charter teachers, in my experience, are mostly eager beaver, interested, thoughtful, want to improve. And I'll bet that they could find the time. Now, and if you're only doing a couple a day, it should be possible. And those conversations don't have to be long psychodramas. They can be, 10-minute conversations. I mean, do you think you could fit a couple of those in? I mean, during the day and with charter, I mean, they can't give you a union pushback. If you want to talk to them, they will.
No, yeah. I think it's more on the personal level of kind of hindering myself from going into more classes in the day, because I know that, okay, if I do 5 classrooms today, then I should be touching base with 5 teachers. The likelihood of them catching me after school between meetings and all that, now we're probably talking just a couple day turnaround.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're trying to do short visits. I'm wondering, with, as a coach, whether it might be less is more, like more longer visits, more, co-teaching, more, sort of working together more like, I know we're running out of time here, and Justin may be about to get out the hook here, but you have access to the Marshall memo?
Yes.
Okay, so if you go to the website to log in, and I think it's Principal Center, I believe, to log in, look under teacher coaching. And there have been a lot of really, really great articles about coaching. It's sort of a dilemma. A lot of coaches get pushed back, and teachers don't want to hear it, or, the teachers who most need it don't get it. There's all these issues. But there really is a way of a coach making a big difference. And one of the biggest ones is looking at student work. With a teacher team. I don't know if you have like grade level teams and they have PLC meetings where they look at the work. Is that a dynamic you can be part of?
Yeah, it's one that's a work in progress right now, but we will definitely have the structure and professional development days next year in our new charter renewal to really move those conversations, do it this year, but really have productive conversations next year.
So rather than kind of micromanaging teaching actions, looking together as a teacher team at how did this work and what was effective in your class and what do I need to change, what ideas can I get from it? Because I think Paul Bamrick Santoyo says all the time, and he's a big charter guy, is that the teacher teamwork, looking at student work together, that is the most powerful driver of improvement. Supervision and so forth can be helpful. But it's the actual teacher teamwork, carving out time for that in the schedule, I think, is absolutely crucial. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like your school is moving in that direction. Are you familiar with Bamrick Santoyo's work at all?
Yes, a little bit, yeah.
His book, Leverage Leadership 2.0, is one of the most powerful books out there. And his schools in Newark, New Jersey, this is where I'm going this afternoon, his schools are unbelievably successful. And they don't have as much teacher turnover, and they've really figured out, these are the North Star Academy charter schools, they've really figured out how to get the teacher teamwork working, and also they're in classrooms frequently and coaching.
Great, that's helpful. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Interesting.
Love it. Love it. And Heather is mentioning the PLC Plus playbook from Fisher and Fry, I believe. And they were some of our earlier guests. And by the way, thinking about some of our past guests on the roundtable here, we've also had Jen Abrams on Hard Conversations. So definitely some good work to check out there. And then, as Kim said, Paul Bamrick Santoyo's work and Doug Lamoff's work. Absolutely. Rachel, one other thing I wanted to mention that I think I never really got the hang of as a principal, but that some of our members suggested to me, people who are going through the instructional leadership challenge and really trying to get serious about getting into classrooms every single day. They said, you know what, I actually made myself note cards and wrote out each teacher's schedule on the note card so I would know, okay, if I go visit this teacher now, are they going to have a free period later in the day, or have I already missed that? Mm-hmm. And just that little bit of planning and being able to kind of anticipate, you know, what's going to come up and, you know, when kind of the optimal time to visit is, really makes a big difference. So we actually took that feedback from our members and designed the note cards. You can get those at principalcenter.com/note cards. Or if you'd like, we have them printed up in batches of 5,000. If you would like some, just let me know. We'll send you some in the mail. And then just have your office staff write those out, get yourself organized. And then, you know, Kim, I say this a little bit sheepishly because we actually have an app that will help you organize this, but I'm still a big advocate of the paper note cards because they're in your face, you know, like they're in your hands.
This is what I carried around in my pocket. So this is the whole schedule, and the big number is when that grade level team has a planning period. So I could see at a glance at any point during the week, you know, it was in my pocket, you know, when I could zero in on people. Now, of course, they might have been busy, they might be running to the bathroom, they might be running stuff off and everything, so you back off. But still, you can be strategic and you can catch those people. And again, it's only a couple a day. So one thing with Rachel is she's trying to do 5 a day. So that's I think, a little bit overload in terms of frequency and especially in terms of being able to catch those people for a meaningful conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and if you are in classrooms, you know, I think it is also okay to say, hey, you know what, I stopped in, I don't really need to say anything to this teacher, so I'm just going to tell him nice to see you today and move along, and then prioritize those ones that, you know, there really is something to talk about. Because just honestly, sometimes there's not. And that really bugs people when there's not really much to talk about. They think, well, I got to find something. I got to, you know, squeeze blood from the turnip. But there's just nothing
Although
there.
That might be the time to ask that question, what did you hope I would notice?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Maybe you didn't see it, but maybe they're aware of it or they're worried about something. So forth.
Love it. So again, I can't recommend highly enough reading the Marshall Memo, and the archives are there. And if anyone is wondering how to get into those archives, I think one of the best ways, Kim, is the book that you just put out with Jen David Lang, The Best of the Marshall Memo, that highlights some of those. And I know we've done a podcast that'll be coming out soon to take people into that book. But final thoughts on anything we've talked about today?
For me or from your I think frequency is the best thing. Authenticity, humility, curiosity, those are the key things here. Looking at student work, always focusing in the classroom, focusing more on what the kids are doing perhaps than what the teacher is doing. Checking in with a couple of kids, what are you working on today? All kinds of insights from that. But I think there really is a certain amount of self-discipline. And just one thing, I do think having a numerical target of classroom visits for the day is very helpful. You know, mine was 3. Yeah. I pushed myself to do 3 a day. And there were bad days when I did 0. And just keeping up a steady pace and keeping it up all year long and being systematic about different parts of the day, different parts of the different groups that teachers are teaching. I think that and those conversations, those face-to-face, that's the heart of the matter. That's the real work. And I think when you go home after doing 2 or 3 of those and having conversations, you just feel like you're in the middle of the work. You know, you're really doing your job. You're making a difference. That's really what it's all about.
Very well said. Well, Kim, it has been an honor and a privilege to speak with you today and to engage in this conversation. Thank you so much, and stay in touch. We'll talk soon. We'll send you the video. But thanks so much for the work you do, and thanks for your consistency and your frequency and your steadiness in putting out the memo every week.
You're welcome. Thanks so much.
All right, everybody. Take care and have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.